Thanks for listening to Access Utah. We're covering an important topic today. It's public lands issues, always a hot topic, and it's come to the forefront recently with Representatives Rob Bishop and Jason Chaffetz unveiling their plan to resolve, as they see it, the decades of deadlock over how eastern Utah's public lands are managed. They characterized it as a sweeping gesture of compromise. Some environmental and tribal groups have declared the proposal dead on arrival, calling it a shameless giveaway to oil and gas interests. And that's characterization in the Salt Lake Tribune, a recent article. John Kovash, our UPR Moab correspondent, has been doing extensive reporting on this, and he joins me for the hour. You're welcome to comment on this. We get all of your comments and questions in as we go along, and they're starting to pick up in pace. We want to get in perspective from the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance now, and we turn to their staff attorney, David Garbutt. Mr. Garbutt, thanks for joining us.
Tom, thanks for having me on the program.
So what's SUA's thoughts on this? What's position on Utah Public Lands Initiative?
Yeah, sure. I think in a nutshell, I would say that Representative Bishop's Public Lands Initiative is really a fossil fuel development bill. It rolls back existing wilderness protections in the state. And as you've heard Representative Chaffetz say, this is all about furthering the state's efforts to seize public lands, to pursue their land grab agenda.
I've heard what John Kovash reported, that your executive director, he at least was thinking out loud that perhaps the representatives were wanting to run out the clock and head off a Bears Ears National Monument.
Yeah, you know, it really has started to feel like that. Interesting listening to both Representative Bishop and Chaffetz talk about this process. And, you know, unfortunately, I think we've seen, especially with Representative Chaffetz, that they are now resorting to, I think, cheap politics and pandering, hearkening to tired platitudes about what has happened during the 3 years it has taken them to develop this proposal and what they're doing now. And you heard Representative Chaffetz say that groups that have given comments on this, environmental organizations like the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, are just in this for the money. We don't really care about land protection. That's simply not true. I mean, that's ludicrous. Mm-hmm. For example, I have a college degree. I have a master's from Utah State. I have a law degree from Harvard. I'm not worried about my employment prospects if Representative Chaffetz were to designate all the wilderness that I want to see in this state. I would definitely find a job. That's just cheap politics. Hmm. He's not really interested in resolving issues here. And you heard Representative Bishop talk about for 3 years that apparently the conservation community has only provided him high-level 30,000-foot comments on what we wanted to see happen and never got into the nitty-gritty. Again, that's just not true. About a year ago, we reached what was the first agreement and what we hoped would be the first of many agreements in Daggett County, one of the counties that was participating in the Public Lands Initiative. It was a really novel agreement, had all kinds of new provisions about how public lands should be managed. It had real conservation. It had wilderness. It was something that was widely held as a landmark and a breakthrough. And Representative Bishop, after that agreement was reached and after promising that this would be part of the bill, decided to strip it out. And why did he strip it out? He stripped it out because one of the county commissioners in Daggett decided he didn't like it. And what we saw at that point is that Bishop wasn't really interested in true compromise. He wasn't interested in a stakeholder-driven process. Instead, what he was interested in was ideology and was ensuring that certain people would have more say in how these public lands were managed. And I think that blows the lid off of what he's talking about now, that this is real compromise. This isn't real compromise. We had real compromise. And Bishop decided that he wasn't going to honor agreements that he made or that he would follow that involved real compromise and stakeholder buy-in.
If you just tuned in, we are talking about the Utah Public Lands Initiative being proposed by Congressman Bishop and Chaffetz. We heard from them earlier in the hour. Still to come, we'll hear from tribal leaders. Right now, we're talking with David Garbutt with the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. I'm joined by John Kovash, our UPR Moab correspondent. This email, I think, is apropos. I'll get Mr. Garbutt's take on this. This is from Tom, who emailed upraxis@gmail.com. You can as well. He says, as Mr. Chaffetz says, rural counties were given this to write. The PLI is not balanced precisely because of this, because the 90% of people who live on the Wasatch Front were excluded from the process. Rural county commissioners are legendary for being the most anti-conservationist group around. Mr. Garber, do you agree with that characterization?
Yeah, and just to pick up again, I think you heard Representative Bishop saying and intimating that opposition is not coming from Utahns. And again, that's simply not true. I'm a Utahn. I live in Salt Lake, grown up and lived in Utah all of my life. You think what we hear from Bishop is that just because he doesn't like what I'm saying, he resorts to tactics like saying that I'm not from Utah or my voice shouldn't matter. These are national public lands. Everyone should have a say. Your listeners that are tuning in from Logan, your listeners that are tuning in from anywhere on the Wasatch Front, your listeners that are tuning in from, say, Iron County in Cedar City or from St. George, you know, I think they could ask themselves, when have I ever had an opportunity to tell Representative Bishop what I want to see for public lands? And the answer is never. I mean, they never made any effort or outreach to talk to Utahns about what they wanted to see until just now, and they're telling you, you know, send us in the next week comments online and we'll get to those. And it just really rings hollow after 3 years that they are interested in public comment. They're not, I think. Like I said, this is an ideological driven bill that is more interested in empowering county commissioners than it is in empowering the public.
Joan Kovash, do you have a question for Mr. Garbutt?
Along those lines, you know, I was thinking about earlier in this process, much was made of perceived commitment by Sally Jewell to not the Antiquities Act wouldn't be exercised until, you know, or that it would be that would be held off while the PLI thing was going on, and that a lot of that local opinion would hold large sway in the decision, and I think that maybe they took that and ran with it a little harder. You know, it kind of ignores the fact that there are 49 other states that care about this one way or another. And my question for David is, if this, let's say this gets into the next congressional series here, and if it got to the point where it actually seemed like it had a chance of passing, would not Obama be able to see this like a slow motion punch and simply put his pen to the Antiquities Act?
Yeah, that's a great question, John. The way that this discussion draft reads right now, that they've put out for the public, there are so many provisions in here that are objectionable and are unrealistic and won't pass Congress, that even if they were to manage to get this through the House and the Senate, I mean, they've loaded it basically with veto bait, and I just can't see President Obama ever signing this into law as it's presently constituted.
Let me get this email in. This is from Chad in Roosevelt. He says, the congressmen refer to this as a balanced approach, and being a Uinta Basin resident who has been involved in this process from the beginning, I want to point out that my opinion that there is nothing balanced about it. As other people have said, it is a giveaway to the oil and gas industry and to motorized recreation. It's nothing but a loss for conservation. The so-called conservation areas would actually not conserve wild lands, but would destroy them through chaining and other destructive activities. It's a very dishonest name game. Chad goes on to say, I feel like my opinion was totally disregarded in all of this. Representative Bishop promised me in person at a meeting in Roosevelt that this would be a win-win and everybody would get something. I feel like he has not kept that promise at all, because PLI would be nothing but a big loss for conservation. That's Chad in Roosevelt. You can comment as well at upraxis@gmail.com. David Garbutt, I want to talk a little bit about, have you talk about a little bit about the, you know, seats at the table. The congressmen are saying that, you know, there were and are conservation groups at the table, tribal groups remaining at the table, and they're disappointed that that groups left the table and are now opposing this?
Yeah, well, a few different things. At the very beginning, when Representative Bishop and Chaffetz announced the Public Lands Initiative, there were a lot of people that were very excited about this and saw it as an opportunity to finally get some of that real protection and real wilderness that we've wanted for decades here in the state. And conservationists, the representatives, we've not always had the best of relationship, but when the Public Lands Initiative started out, I think there was a different feeling, and there really was some great dialogue, and there was listening from the offices of both Representative Bishop and Chaffetz. And that's why I go back to Daggett County. I think that's why we were able to reach some consensus agreements in some of these counties. But somewhere along the way, things got off track, and I think it was at the point where Representative Bishop and Chaffetz realized that their ideology and their pursuit of, like I said, this land grab mentality, this idea that the state should take over public lands, I think that got in the way. And this end product is not something that represents consensus-driven solutions. This is not real compromise. And let me just unpack that a little bit. You know, Representative Chaffetz and Bishop have both said that conservationists should be happy because we're getting protection here. As I said at the beginning, they actually rolled back protection on the ground. If this bill were passed today, there would be less land in Utah managed as wilderness than what public land managers are managing now. And not only would there be less land managed as wilderness, when I say wilderness and when I think of the Wilderness Act and the legal infrastructure instituting that act, they're defining it in an entirely different way. I mean, this is an apples to oranges comparison. They're not even designating real wilderness. And you've heard some of your callers ask about that. You had a caller asking about grazing language, for example. So there would be less protection under this bill than what we have today. So what is, like you've heard some of your callers say, what is in this for me? What is the conservation victory? You know, I'm having a very hard time seeing what it is that is good for conservation in this bill.
If you just joined us, we are you're listening to Access Utah on Utah Public Radio. I'm Tom Williams, and I'm joined for the hour and more than the hour by John Kovach, who is our UPR Moab correspondent. Right now we have with us David Garbutt, staff attorney for Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. Later on, we'll be talking with tribal leaders from the Barrisiers Intertribal Coalition. Earlier in the program, we heard from Congressman Bishop and Chaffetz. We're hearing from you as well. That's a very important part of this program. We do have some emails to get to. You can call us as well at 1-800-826-1495. Email us to upraccess@gmail.com. We'll be going till at least 20 past the hour with this very important topic. We pause right now for station identification.
This is KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, KCEU 89.7 Price, and KUSUFM HD1 91.5 Logan.
And you're listening to Access Utah. Here's an email from Hillary. She's from Bridgeland Audubon Society. She says, thank you so much for covering this important topic. I wonder if you've alerted other groups that should have a say in this forum, notably those misrepresented in a recent Herald Journal editorial by Kathy Archer, who implied that they are all on board, when in fact nothing could be further from the truth. And she lists those groups who are apparently listed in this editorial. They are the Nature Conservancy, Wilderness Society, Friends of Cedar Mesa, Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, Indian Tribes. Thanks, she says, Hillary from Bridgeland Audubon Society. So we have a representative from one of those groups with us, David Garbutt, Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. And as we've heard, your group is definitely not on board.
No. And again, as I said at the beginning in my comments, this bill is really about fossil fuel development. It's about rolling back existing protections on the land, and it's about furthering the state's land grab, despite how they're dressing this up and despite numbers that they talk about.
John, do you have another question for David Garbutt?
I was about to throw in that SUA has been joined in this position by a who's who of mainstream green groups, including the Sierra Club, Grand Canyon Trust, National Resources Defense Council. The list is grows larger by the day, so that's certainly correct context there.
I'd like to get your reaction, David Garbutt, to this. It's a somewhat lengthy email. I'll read this as quickly as I can. I want to get this in, though. This is a different perspective. This is from Cliff Kuntz, who is Executive Director of Ride With Respect. He says, thanks to UPR for covering this important issue. I work for an off-highway vehicle group that has spent thousands of hours maintaining trails within the Bears Ears Monument proposal to the benefit of all visitors and natural resources. Although national monuments don't necessarily exclude OHV recreation, so far they have severely restricted it in every case. Further, Bears Ears is proposed by Native American tribes outside of Utah that have received millions of dollars from groups seeking to vastly expand wilderness designations. In the past, these tribes and wilderness groups have proposed wilderness that would close these specific trails that I maintain, prohibiting OHV and even bicycle use. This intention is confirmed by the Bears Ears Monument proposal, which states that motorized vehicle use should be permitted only on designated roads, while going on to state that other uses should be permitted on roads and trails. I respect the concerns of conservationists and tribes inside of Utah and recognize that the discussion draft of the PLI will need to be refined over the coming weeks and months, but the PLI proposes to designate a national conservation area from the Arizona border northward to the county line, just 8 miles from Moab, which covers most of the Bears Ears Monument proposal and covers more than previous proposals from the same wilderness groups and tribes outside of Utah. Last paragraph here, whether it's the Bundys or the Bears Ears, this refusal to give an inch won't benefit anyone or anything in public lands. Everyone who witnesses OHV trail work seems to appreciate it, so common ground clearly exists. We just need to resolve and work through the difficulties of legislation, since doing so would resolve far more than a monument ever could. That's Cliff Kuntz from Ride With Respect. So there's a lot in there, David Garbutt. I want to first put that last part to you. And this, I think the congressman, Bishop and Chaffetz, would agree on this, that refusal to give an inch won't benefit anything or anyone. And I think that Mr. Kuntz is perhaps lumping in SUA here. I'm guessing the congressman probably would. What do you say to that? Refusal to compromise?
No, I agree with him. Refusal to compromise does not lead to productive discussions. It doesn't lead to long-term certainty. But that's not what is happening in the Public Lands Initiative. As I said, we reached consensus agreement. We showed we could compromise in Daggett County. We walked away from areas that we had been proposing for protection in America's Red Rock Wilderness Act. We also reached a compromise agreement in Summit County. So given the time and the ability and the opportunity to actually have those sorts of discussions, we have shown that we can do that. I would turn that around and say, where has Representative Bishop, where has Representative Chaffetz shown that they can do that? They haven't. And as you pointed out, I think it was you, Tom, a lot of opposition to this bill is, you're hearing basically every conservation group in the state and in the country say they don't like this bill. You've heard a lot of energy developers say they like this bill. You've heard people like Cliff Kuntz, who favor off-road vehicle recreation, say they like this bill. You know, compromise isn't a one-way street. And Cliff should be very happy about this bill. One of the things that Representative Bishop's Public Lands Initiative does is that it turns over to the state of Utah more than 10,000 miles of dirt roads, two tracks, and cow trails as quote-unquote public highways, 66-foot wide public highways. So all of these routes that Cliff is talking about, routes that may see little to no use, mechanized use ever, those will be designated as highways under Representative Bishop's proposal. So, of course, he should be happy about this, but if you want to see wilderness in this state, if you think that not every cow trail should become a public highway, then this is not a winning proposal, and it doesn't involve compromise. I mean, Representative Bishop gives the state potentially everything they ask for, and if he's not giving them everything they ask for in terms of rights of way for public highways, he's giving them most of what they want and then allowing them to pursue litigation to claim the rest, even inside of the wilderness he designates. That's not long-term certainty. That's not a stakeholder-driven process. That's not compromise. So again, I would go back to Cliff and to Representative Bishop and Chaffetz and say, you show me where that real compromise is. You show me where you've actually done something that advances conservation and where you're not just furthering the state's land grab. And then I think we have real discussion points, but for all their platitudes, they can't, and they don't. I mean, that's just not in this public lands initiative.
We're coming to the end of this segment. John Kovach, I wonder if there's anything in Cliff's email there that we perhaps haven't unpacked there that we ought to address, maybe that you want to.
Well, the reference to ATVs, that's actually a very central issue with Bears Ears. The Navajos, the ATV spreading is one of the things that they hate the most, and they don't like the new roads, and they are proposing an area that remains relatively roadless and pristine, and they would, it's probably, you know, would be reasonable to expect that you wouldn't, if they managed this land, it wouldn't be for ATVs for sure.
Let me get this email in. We'll have to let David Garber go. We need to bring on the tribal leaders. But this is an email from Ronnie, who says the PLI, titled The Livestock Grazing Issue on PLI. And here's the email. The PLI would create a new kind of unwilderness, tying the hands of land managers. Existing livestock numbers would be mandated to remain the same or increase. In this new quote-unquote wilderness, ranchers could use ATVs to place feed and bulldozers to build new infrastructure. The Forest Service would be barred from considering the continued existence or disappearance of species or species habitat when making grazing decisions. Congress must leave land management decisions up to land management agencies. That's from Ronnie. What do you think on that, David Garbutt?
I think that's a great point. I mean, if we had 2 hours, we could go through this entire bill and point out all kinds of loopholes and caveats. And that's why I was saying even the wilderness they do designate as a poor imitation. And so, again, it would be great if we could have real compromise. We just haven't seen it here. And we need to get past these platitudes of saying that people that are offering commentary about national public lands aren't Utahns and they can't have a say. I mean, I'm glad you have somebody coming on from the Intertribal Coalition to talk about Bears Ears, because the idea that tribes, you know, the original Utahns, the Utahns before there was a Utah, shouldn't have a say in our national public lands, that's unfortunate, and that's not something that will ever lead to real compromise and real solutions.
I just want to get this one in as well. It's from Chris. He says, an email, I would ask each of the participants to provide listeners with their view of the region's landscape 25 years hence under this particular piece of legislation. Follow up, how does the bill provide for environmental health of the entire region?
Yeah, well, under Bishop's vision, 25 years from now, you will have more land dedicated to fossil fuel development than you will to conservation. So we'll have lost places like Mullen Reef or the San Rafael Desert, or we'll have lost places like the Southern Book Cliffs and Bitter Creek to oil and gas development. You will have a network of roads so that it's impossible to go anywhere on public lands and not escape the line of motors, and those associated impacts to escape the looting and vandalism that necessarily comes along with routes and access. And we will have lost protection for a lot of iconic landscapes, places like Desolation Canyon, Labyrinth Canyon, even the San Rafael Swell. So under Bishop's vision, I think it's a sad picture. You know, I would prefer to see the heritage that we have now protected. I would prefer to see these areas that Utahns know and love, places like Desolation Canyon, Labyrinth Canyon, Fisher Towers, I would prefer to see these places protected for us today and for future generations. And we need something different than the Public Lands Initiative to make that happen. And I would say I would prefer to see the tribe's vision of Bears Ears realized. I think they've put forward an amazing proposal, something that in 25 years, we can guarantee all Utahns will know and will love and will prize the same way that we appreciate our other designated national monuments and national parks.
Final question, say a listener is agreeing with you or perhaps disagreeing. What would you suggest? What would you have them do on this?
I would have them go to our website, which is SUA.org. Again, that's www.sua.org, and they can read more about our objections to this bill and our vision for what we would like to see in the state. And they're welcome to go to the Utah PLI website and compare as well.
All right. David Garbutt, staff attorney for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, has been with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Tom.
We've heard earlier in the program from Congressman Rob Bishop, Congressman Jason Chaffetz, right there, David Garbutt from SUA. And we will conclude the program coming up following a break with conversation with tribal leaders from the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. And I'm joined throughout the program by John Kovash, UPR's Moab correspondent. Before we go to break, John, what would you say at this point after we've now talked with Dave Garbutt from SUA?
I think the next segment will be the most interesting yet because having just plowed through a long Bears Ears proposal, it's a fascinating document. I've learned that... for example, a big part of their issue is the continued unabated artifact looting in that. That's an area that they have mentioned has literally, perhaps 100,000 cultural sites, they don't like industrial development, and that's what pretty much froze them out of it, getting anywhere with San Juan County and. So I think we'll hear some interesting concepts here.
So coming up following a break, we'll be talking with Eric Deschaney, who's senior advisor of the Navajo Nation Office of President and Vice President and co-chair of the Bears Ears Tribal Coalition, and Charles Wilkinson from Window Rock, Arizona, nationally recognized expert on Indian and federal public land law and policy at the University of Colorado Law School, special advisor to the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. That conversation, along with John Kovash, is coming up following the break.
I'm Robin Young. Author Boz Dreisinger visited prisons around the world and found practices more geared to helping prisoners make amends to victims and just make it on the outside.
Restorative justice already exists in our systems, so we're already using this model. We're just using it on a very minimal scale.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Join us Wednesday morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Hey, what's up? I'm Shad. On her new album, Good Advice, Basha Bulat extends her folk songwriting chops onto a retro pop canvas. It's a big step forward for the Canadian musician, and next time on Q, she'll drop by to perform live. You don't want to miss it. That's Basha Bulat coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
Join us this afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
Next time on Ask Me Another, Jim Gaffigan gets patriotic about fast food.
So the donut ham hamburger, I think, is it's not America's proudest moment. But it shows that innovation is still alive.
Join me, Ophira Eisenberg, and comedian Jim Gaffigan on Ask Me Another, NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
Join us Saturday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. And if you're just tuning in, you're wondering, where is my regularly scheduled program? We'll get you to that in about 10 or 15 minutes. We're going along today on the program. It's a big issue, very interesting issue, and a lot of people are wanting to comment. You can continue to comment at upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com, or you can call us toll-free, 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. Love to get your opinion on the Utah Public Lands Initiative and related topics, and we'll talk about the proposed Bears Ears National Monument as well. We've talked with Congressman Bishop and Chaffetz. We've also talked with David Garbutt from the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. And I'm joined throughout the program here by John Kovach, UPR's Moab correspondent. And we bring in now representatives from the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. And we bring in Eric Deschini. Hope I'm saying your name right. Senior advisor of the Navajo Nation Office of the President and Vice President. He's in Window Rock, Arizona, and co-chair of the Bears Ears Tribal Coalition. Welcome to the program. I think we're trying to get to our other guest on. Mr. Deschini, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, I can.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you for having me.
We appreciate you being on with us. And we also bring on Charles Wilkinson, who's a nationally recognized expert in Indian and federal public land law and policy at the University of Colorado Law School and special advisor to the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. Mr. Wilkinson, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Appreciate you being with us. John Kovach, I'll give you first question here.
Okay, well, there's a lot of ground to cover here, but could you talk about how far back this goes? Because they talk about it being newcomers and outsiders operating in San Juan County, but this has gone back to 2010, I believe, when you first started working with our ex-senator on Bears Ears. This actually goes back quite a ways back, further than the PLI does.
Yes, absolutely, John. It does go back quite a ways. It goes back quite a ways past 2010. It goes back to really our creation stories, time immemorial, when time began, consistent with the way our respective tribes understand our cosmologies. We asked this fundamental question, the same question that you're asking. I said, when did this all start? And the first response that came out from one of our elders was just what I stated, is from the very beginning. Our people have been occupying these lands, and when I say our people, it's just not Navajo people, it's Utes, it's Pueblos, Hopi Zunis, there's many others. And so it's important to understand the perspective of our indigenous peoples, in that we relate to these lands in a very traditional religious way, ways in which is a genuinely alternative from Western kind of thinking, and of course, and very much precedes and is alternative to our modern political lines as we know it today. So it's important to understand that our people, our purpose in participating in the PLI from 2010 to 2016 is very much rooted in this ideology and this understanding and the way in which we relate to one another and also to land. From an initiative standpoint, from a political standpoint, yes, in 2010, our local leadership across what's often referred to as the Utah Strip of the Navajo Nation. Our people have been gathering data, cataloging information specific to how our people utilize the land, how our people have occupied the land, be it sustenance, wood gathering, picking berries, whatever that might consist of. And then, of course, our ceremonies, our traditional ways of practicing, gathering herbs for medicinal uses. And then, of course, we have a lot of concern over looting, grave robbing, things of that nature, which is has been going on for quite some time in the southeastern Utah, particularly the Bears Ears region. And so, a lot of our folks doing a lot of the groundwork, going from hogan to hogan, house to house, community to community, and that's all seven communities, consistent with our local units of government within the Navajo Nation, what we refer to as chapters. We've transcended all of those areas and captured very specifically, family by family, what they do and where they go and the kinds of ceremonies. And these ceremonies are really no different than prayer or going to the medical doctor's office. And, we seek happiness, we seek joy, we seek healing. And so, the way in which we go to these lands provides for the same type of interest. So to answer your question, it's kind of a long, drawn-out question, but, our people relate to these lands from way, way back when, And then, of course, since 2010, when Senator Bennett, generated these discussions about resolving some of Utah's most challenging public lands issues, so our people took a great deal of initiative in capturing in great detail. And I think it's important, and I'll just finish off my answer with this, is that 1.9 million acre map is, first and foremost, is a cultural map. Consistent with what our people have gathered and cataloged, and a software database driven purpose, and so it's first and foremost a cultural map, and very much of course has a conservation purpose as well. But I've talked to many folks since I've started working on this, and nobody has seen a map like that. Particularly with respect to its scale. And so it's a very powerful map, rooted in, our oral history and our traditional practices going back centuries. So I know it's a long, drawn-out question, or I'm sorry, response to your question, but that's where we've been, and that's our purpose.
Professor Wilkinson, I wonder, given that foundation that Mr. Discini gave us, I believe the Bears Ears Coalition finds the current proposal in its current state deficient. Why so? What are some specific points there?
Specifics in the proposal.
As to why the certain of the tribal leaders are, at least the coalition is wanting to go away from that and have a designation of a national monument.
Yeah. Well. Boy, it's a long list, and I won't go through all of it, but really, in a sense, the starting point is the horrible grave robbing and pot stealing that has taken place now over the course of a full century. And it's unspeakable, really, and it's unspeakable to us non-natives, but just imagine how native people feel at their ancestors literally being dug up out of the ground. And it's been going on, and it's essentially unstopped. The unenforcement, enforcement is weak, and it's hard to do. That's big open country out there. And but one thing that this monument will lead to is increased enforcement, so that those activities come under much greater scrutiny, and we can finally begin to have some relief from those horrors, really. The idea of off-road vehicles also, it isn't that the tribes are against off-road vehicles necessarily. If it's done right, if it's on trails, under some circumstances, but we're seeing real destruction going on in places such as Arch Canyon and elsewhere, and that ground's getting chewed up, and it really needs to be brought under reasonable control, and that would be an objective. Having a withdrawal of this whole area from mining is another objective. And there's potash out there, there's oil and gas, there's uranium, and the request that we've made of President Obama is to withdraw it all from mining in the future. Current mining, those are vested rights, but in the future, mining will be shut down. And in an area that is hard for people to imagine, I think, but the proposal is that the tribes become joint managers, collaborative management. It's the first time that it has ever been achieved, if it happens. There's never been a time where a public land unit comes under collaborative management with tribes. And how extraordinary it would be to have the Indian voice fully reflected in this area that people have lived in for thousands of years, and to have the public have the benefit of that, and to have public exhibits, to have demonstrations of weaving and basket making, to have exploration of traditional knowledge, both in a practical way, just having more sensitive environmental management, but also philosophically, how we've never had an opportunity to see what kind of terrific land management you can have with the kind of land management that we've traditionally had in the public lands, blended together with the tribal worldview. And it's going to result in better land management and more expansive land management, with more attention to medicines and all the animals and plants and springs, for sure. It's going to happen. So you can list other things, but this is going to be one of the great public land units anywhere in the country. It is really going to be exciting, and it's going to be different, and it's going to present the Indian worldview in a way that it's never been done before, because they will be joint managers.
Now, the Barrasier's proposal admits that there is no precedent for this, literally, but points out that there is lots of precedent for federal management directions to be enacted along with a new area like this. Could you comment on that? And also, I thought it's very interesting, the concepts of using both Western science and traditional knowledge to guide your management, and even to build a traditional knowledge center at the Barrasier's. Can you talk about that part of it?
Yes. You say we admit there is no precedent. We don't look at it that way. When a great idea comes forward, every great idea we've ever had, including wilderness and national parks and so forth and endangered species, there's been no precedent. I mean, that's just the way important new ideas are. So, and so we don't want to somehow argue that there's precedent, and we can make an argument for that, but it is better to say that there isn't precedent, but of course there isn't. And that's not in any way a limitation. You know, what is important to recognize here is the advances that tribes have made in land management over the past two generations. These five tribes, who the Navajos are managing 16 million acres, larger than the state of West Virginia. The other four tribes manage nearly 4 million acres now. And in the past, when the BIA really kept down tribes and suppressed them in the most specific way, and that's just straight history, so they didn't have the opportunity to manage their own lands. But starting in the 60s, early 70s, starting with nothing, they have developed very sophisticated, scientific-based, traditional knowledge-based management systems for cultural and natural resource systems. And so that wave of tribal activity of modern tribes, often relying, of course, on traditional knowledge, is, if not precedent, is the reason that now this proposal becomes so realistic. I think that's the point of that. And so, and you mentioned briefly the idea of having a Barrasier's Traditional Knowledge Institute, which is raised in the tribe's proposal. And I'm glad you brought that out, because it's one of the great possibilities of this. And what the tribes want to do, and there's great foundation interest in this, there really is. This is a realistic dream, to have a world-class institute in traditional knowledge. Steve Martin, the former superintendent of Grand Canyon National Park, has said that collaboration between indigenous governments and states, meaning states in the international sense, is the most important movement in global land management today. And this would be the best example in the world of that. And so there are these kinds of possibilities here that are dreams, yes, but boy, are they real dreams.
If you just joined us, we are talking about Utah Public Land Initiative. We're also talking about related issues, including a proposed Bears Ears National Monument. Right now, we're talking with representatives from the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. Eric Deschini, a senior advisor with the Navajo Nation Office of the President and Vice President. He's co-chair of the Bears Ears Tribal Coalition. We're also talking with Charles Wilkinson, a nationally recognized expert in Indian and federal public land law and policy. He's at the University of Colorado Law School and a special advisor to the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. We're joined through this entire program by John Kovash, UPR's Moab correspondent. You can still get to us. We have another 5 or so minutes left in the program. With your comment or questions, we'd love to get your comments and questions at 1-800-826-1495 or upraccess@gmail.com. I want to direct this question to Mr. Deschini. This is an email we got a little earlier in the program. This is from Jean Laun. She says, Chaffetz's comment on paid activists, and Chaffetz made reference to what he characterized as people who were paid to keep this going and to not compromise. Paid activists ignores the fact that the energy industry has legions of very well-paid professional lobbyists. The environmental groups operate on a shoestring with very few staff who are paid far less than the professional energy lobbyists. The question I want to kind of relate it to this, to Mr. Deschini, is Congressman Chaffetz, also in my interview with him earlier, characterized the opposition from the tribes, anyways, coming from tribes outside of Utah. And he said there's still tribes at the table on the PLI. I wonder what your response to that is.
If I could understand the question a little bit more, he observed that there were tribes.
I put this to him that I talked about the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition, that your group wants a national monument instead of the PLI, and he said, "Oh, there," and that the fact that some tribes had been at the table had left, been dissatisfied with where the PLI was going, and he said, "Oh, there are plenty of tribes still at the table," and he further characterized that the opposition is coming from tribal leaders outside of Utah, and that this ought to be a Utah thing.
Oh, yeah, I understand the question now. Thank you. Yes, that is true. There are many tribes, even beyond the five tribes who comprise the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. I think for the listeners' understanding of the composition of the coalition, you have up in Fort Duchesne, Uinta and Ure-U tribe, a very, very large tribe in terms of land base. And then you have the Ute Mountain Ute tribe, who's shares jurisdiction with the state of Utah, with the White Mesa community. They're headquartered in Toya, Colorado. And then we have the Hopi tribe, and the Hopi people reside entirely within the state of Arizona. And then you have the Zuni tribe, which largely is their land base rests in New Mexico. The Hopi tribe and the Zuni, but the Pueblo Zuni, they represent the many tribes, upwards to, in excess of 20 Pueblos in New Mexico. Mind you that the Bears Ears landscape is home to many artifacts, evidence of our Pueblo relatives, our people who at one point resided there, lived there, and to this day still return back to perform ceremonies, to provide for healing, to provide for happiness. I mean, it's so important, and I really emphasize happiness because I think in a lot of these types of discussions, particularly with respect to politics, we lose sight of the humanistic endeavor in all of this. Why are we doing what we're doing? And that brings me to my very, a very important factor here is that, I facilitated in large part most of our discussions as co-chair of this coalition. And in the very first thing that I did was I asked the five tribes, and there were actually more in the room at the time, I asked them, I said, why are we doing what we're doing? Because ultimately, the way we answer that question now needs to still be the same at the very end. And there really is no end, because all of this, you know, the way in which we relate to these lands, you know, interpersonally, intersubjectively, with the beings that live within the bear's ears, I'm talking about other than human beings that we correlate, that we communicate with, that we live with, you know, and we communicate with them in ceremony, you know, consistent with creation stories, you know, exhibited verbatim. You know, there's a whole other world, there's a whole other traditional knowledge that exists out there. And when I ask the tribal leaders and the traditional medicine people in the room, why are we doing what we're doing? And by and large, 80 to 90% of everything that came out of their mouths had everything to do with our rights to participate in ceremony at these lands, our rights to gather herbs to provide for healing, medicinal purpose. This is not only a human right, but this is an indigenous right that, you know, that we have had before, you know, before our various communities arrived, before folks came across the oceans to create the communities that we have today. These are all human rights that speak to why it's so important that we have the access, why we have the ability to go to the Bear's Ears Twin Buttes and perform ceremonies. And it's just not there, but there are other places around. And so, you know, and that's still the truth today. The truth today is no different from when we started, and that is that we have to be able to provide for our own respective healing, healing for our children, healing for our families, healing for a people, and even far beyond that, healing for non-Indian people, including our adversaries, you know, including the people who strongly oppose what we're trying to do. Our purpose is to provide for not only healing for the land in terms of an ecological standpoint, but also from an inter-community standpoint. My participation in all of this has shown me that we lack a certain kind of community in the southeastern Utah area. And part of the problem is the way in which we think about ourselves in relationship to others. And so part of our challenge with the Bear's Ears Intertribal Coalition is not only to try to have a conservation conscience, an environmental conscience, you know, one that's consistent with, our traditional intellectual lenses, but also one is to try to inspire the creation of a new community where we can begin to treat each other better, treat each other with more of a humanistic purpose. And so that is the reason why this intertribal coalition, and I think it's really important to acknowledge that this is a union of five sovereign tribal governments, the five good tribes that I've mentioned, coalescing for these purposes. And we are joined by way of memorandum of understanding, signed off by the top elected leaders of each of our governments, governors, chairmen, presidents. And so it's absolutely critical to understand where the tribes are coming from. Why are we doing what we're doing? This is not just an organized fist fight, as the way it's turned out to be. There is a genuine human purpose in this, and it goes far beyond our own communities. And so, you know, I can't emphasize, you know, our purpose enough. And so, you know, it's and I hope I'm answering your question, but
certainly.
It's just really critical to understand, you know, the traditional lens of things. And just the last point is that you brought up in your first question was this matching up of traditional knowledge with Western science in a world-class institute that would rest somewhere within the landscape of the Bear's Ears. As of right now, you know, Diné College, which is an accredited, you know, institution here in Salie, Arizona, not to mention Navajo Technical University, you know, which largely rests in Crown Point, New Mexico, on the Navajo Nation, we already are talking about that. We already are producing a curriculum that begins to, you know, assess kind of Western knowledge, traditional knowledge from a philosophical standpoint, from a practical standpoint, from an academic standpoint. How do they relate? Do they at all? And how can we push them together to provide new knowledge that not only benefits Native American communities, it benefits the entire, you know, country. It benefits to the entire public. And so it's so important to one, recognize that a lot of this work is already unfolding. And the possibilities of it, you know, Charles mentioned it's one of the great possibilities. Absolutely. It's an exciting time. I mean, granted, right now, you know, there's a lot of differing opinions between the leaders of the PLI, you know, our tribes, and, you know, among others. But we have not lost sight of how exciting this proposal is. Never have tribes petitioned the United States government to create a national monument consistent with the truths that come from the heart of Indian country. This is the first time, you know, that we have petitioned the use of the Antiquities Act of 1906. And so we're very thrilled about the possibilities, and we're inspired by these truths that are not our own, but they go far into our ancestors and the things that they want for our people going forward. And so, I'll finish with this: I acknowledge the concerns that, you know, the opposition that we've received. I try to, I exhibit as much respect as I can, and to the extent that I try to listen before speaking. But by and large, you know, this proposal is exciting, and our hope is that we know someday we'll be able to, you know, celebrate from the fruits of our labor. And when I say our, it's just not Indian people; it's everybody in the state of Utah, going into Colorado, going into New Mexico, and going into Arizona. And this is my last statement with respect to this question: is that, you know, we are so divided by political lines. And these lines can move and shift and what have you. But the one thing that doesn't divide us is the air, the water, the land, animals. I mean, the entire environment. We live in a global society now where we're talking about, you know, ecological changes not only, you know, from a close proximity standpoint, from a global standpoint, the climate change discussions. You know, we're citizens of this world. And we all have a responsibility to take care of the landscape, to take care of our climate. And so while, you know, some folks want to draw lines and say, you don't belong here, we kindly and respectfully push back and say, absolutely not.
I think that's a good place to end this. We're at the end of this segment, but very, very well stated. Eric Deschini is senior advisor with the Navajo Nation Office of President, Vice President, co-chair of the Bears Ears Tribal Coalition in Window Rock, Arizona. Mr. Deschini, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And we've been joined as well by Charles Wilkinson, who's a nationally recognized expert in Indian and federal public land law and policy at the University of Colorado Law School. He's a special advisor to the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. Professor Wilkinson, thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate all of our guests joining us. We have a couple more emails. I want to follow up with that and get some final comments, more specifically questions that John Kovach has going forward. Let me get to this one first, and then I'll briefly wrap up with Mr. Kovach. This is from an email from Benjamin Smith. And it's a little bit lengthy, but I want to get everybody's in. Everybody has an interesting take on this issue. He emailed us. He says, see letter below, emailed to Mr. Bishop concerning this issue. Honorable Mr. Bishop, thank you for your sustained effort to find collaborative resolution to public land conflict in eastern Utah counties. I believe there is great opportunity in taking this approach and that the draft PLI is an excellent outcome from a challenging process. I've been encouraging all parties, conservation organizations, federal DOI, to engage the process and work to find an acceptable legislative compromise. Protection of the spectacular world-class landscapes of Utah, along with enhanced economic certainty for local communities, can be achieved. I don't pretend to be an expert in Utah land management, but offer the following couple of thoughts. One, ranchers that graze public land should not be penalized simply because an area is designated wilderness. That is, grazing levels should not be reduced simply for the fact of it being wilderness, as the draft PLI states. However, the amount of grazing should be based on some way in some way, hopefully scientifically, on the resource condition. Two, one thing that's notable about arches and canyonlands and much of the Colorado Plateau in general is the high quality of air quality. I would hope that today's development technologies and approaches could sustain the Class 1 air quality we've become accustomed to at places like Arches. Three, based on many visits to Moab and nearby, I agree strongly with your proposal to enlarge Arches, conserve the areas immediately east of the Canyonlands Needle section, protect the Colorado River corridor. Additionally, though not included in the draft PLI but mentioned in earlier press releases, I believe Dinosaur National Monument is worthy of national park status. Seems to be a proper recognition and potential bonanza for the local tourist economy, especially if it's lumped in PR with other Utah National Park visitor magnets. Now is the time. Thanks for your consideration of these comments and best wishes on success of this endeavor. Sincerely, Benjamin Smith. So I wanted to get that in here. John Kovach, obviously there's a lot of interest, a lot of emotion in this issue, as evidenced by the fact that we've got an extra hour here. I wonder what your questions are going forward.
Gosh, we've covered a lot of ground. I'd encourage listeners to learn more. Read the PLI draft, read the Bears Ears proposal. Especially look at a map of Bears Ears just to see what an amazing area it is, and just the place names that you will recognize, just legendary place names, the Valley of the Gods and Grand Gulch and White Canyon and Indian Creek and the Abajo Mountains. It's an amazing area, and especially to learn about what is being proposed as to how to manage it is kind of a really new thing that could become a way of the future for certain lands.
Here's another email. It's just come in. I want to fit this in before we close. This is from Marcel Rodriguez. He says, Utah has 6 representatives in the present Congress. Nothing even remotely good or conducive to continued life on the planet will ever come from any of them. Public lands bill is no exception. Hopefully we'll not get to first base. I always urge people to call or write senators or congressional representatives from states that understand environmental needs of Utah and the planet. There's nothing to be hoped for from our state's federal representatives. Having recently attended a congressional committee hearing in St. George, I'm more than ever convinced that our representatives in Washington speak for big money, massive development, and their own small-minded outlooks. That's from Marcel. And we've had a lot of response to the program. Keep that coming. 2 venues, upr.org. That's our website. Look for our program there, and you can comment there, upr.org. And our email, upraccess@gmail.com. I just want to close with this one. This is from Steve Kent. Dear Tom and Company, I represent a group called Take Back the Chunk, a group of Utahns dedicated to transferring the southwest corner of Wyoming to Utah's control, thus making our great state a rectangle, as opposed to its irregular hexagon status quo. We'd like to applaud Utah's $14 million initiative to seize control of federal lands within the state. Take Back the Chunk has the same kind of bureaucratic doublespeak the Utah land grab faces. Criticisms like, quote, Utah has no legal right to that land, end quote, and, quote, you're willfully misrepresenting and or making up history, end quote. But we will not be hindered by such frivolous claims. Also, please find us on Facebook. And yeah, I did go to their Facebook site. Take Back the Chunk. Our About tab explains our historical claims in detail. That's from Steve Kent. I believe that's a tongue-in-cheek effort. John, have you heard of Take Back the Chunk?
No, that's great, though. I've always heard that Moab should become part of Colorado, but I haven't heard that one.
And as a resident of what we call northeastern Utah, you know, it's south of the Chunk. My hometown's Vernal.
Maybe I'd
support Take Back the Chunk. Anyway, thank you to everyone who has responded to this important issue. And as I say, keep those comments coming. And John Kovach, of course, will be continuing to report on this issue and many others. John Kovach, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for hosting, Tom.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah. I want to mention that coming up tomorrow, the future of libraries. It's an institution that many of us love. And will there be a place in today's digital world or tomorrow's digital world for the library? That's what we're talking about tomorrow. Hope you'll join us tomorrow. Thanks for listening today.